This is lecture 13 of the collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth. Lecture 13 is entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth, Man's Journey Through the Cosmic Spheres After Death, given in Munich, March 12, 1913. During my last visit here, I spoke about man's life between death and rebirth, and how that life is connected with the great realm of the cosmos. I wanted to show how the path traversed by the human being between death and a new birth actually leads through the cosmic spheres. Let us now briefly recapitulate what was said then. The first period after a man's death is filled with experiences connected in some way with his recent life on Earth. He is emerging from, growing away from, his last earthly life, and during the first period after death, the emotions, passions, and feelings that affected his astral body all continue to exist. Because during physical incarnation, man is conscious of these feelings only when he is actually within his physical body, it is natural that his experiences of all these forces in the astral body is essentially different when he is passing through the region of existence between death and a new birth. In normal cases, although there are many exceptions, a sense of deprivation is present during the first period after death. This is due to the fact that man must live through the experiences in his astral body without having a physical body at his disposal. He still longs for his physical body, and in normal cases this longing holds him back in the sphere of the earth for a longer or shorter period. Life in Kamaloka takes its course in the sphere between the earth and the orbit of the moon. But experiences in Kamaloka that are of essential significance take place in a realm nearer the earth than, let us say, the orbit of the moon. Souls who have unfolded only few feelings and sentiments, transcending the affairs of earthly life, remain bound to the earth sphere by their own cravings for a considerable time. Even outwardly, it is easy to understand that a man who, for a whole lifetime, has cultivated only such feelings as can be satisfied by means of bodily organs and earthly conditions, can but remain bound to the earth sphere for a certain time. Impulses and desires quite different from those ordinarily imagined can also cause a soul to remain bound to the earth sphere. Ambitious people, for instance, who cultivate an inordinate longing for certain things within earthly conditions, and who depend on the appreciation of their fellow men, thereby develop an emotional disturbance in their astral body that will result in their being bound to the earth sphere for a longer time after death. There are many reasons for which human souls are held back in the earth sphere. By far the greater majority of communications from the spirit world made by mediums stem from such souls and consist essentially of what they are striving to cast off. Although the motives binding these souls to the earth are mostly ignoble, it need not invariably be so. It may also be due to anxiety for those who have been left behind on earth. Concern for friends, relatives, and children may also act as a kind of gravity that holds souls back in the earth sphere. It is important to pay attention to this because by taking it into account we can also help the dead. If, for instance, we realize that the departed soul feels anxiety for a living person, and much can come to our knowledge in this respect, it will help the dead person in his further development to relieve him of this anxiety. We ease the life of someone who has died by relieving him, for example, of anxiety about a child whom he has left behind unprovided for. By doing something for the child, we relieve the dead person of anxiety, and this is a true service of love. Let us picture such a situation. The dead person has not available the means to rid himself of anxiety. From his realm he may be unable to do anything that would ease the circumstances of a child, a relative, or a friend. He is often condemned, and in many cases this weighs heavily upon the seer. To bear the anxiety until the situation of the one left behind improves of itself or by circumstances. Therefore, if we do something to better the situation, we will have performed a real deed of love for the dead one. It has frequently been observed that a person who had planned to do something definite in life died and then continued to cling to the plan after his death. We help him if we ourselves attempt to do what he would have liked to do. These situations are not difficult to grasp. we should take account of them because they tally with clairvoyant observation. There are many other facts that may keep a soul in the etheric sphere of the earth. Eventually he grows beyond this sphere. This process has already partly been described. Our concepts must be recast if we wish to gain an understanding of the life between death and rebirth. It is not really incongruous to speak about the dead in words taken from the conditions of earthly life, because our language is adapted to these conditions. Although what can be expressed in words about life after death tallies only in a pictorial sense, it need not necessarily be incorrect. Descriptions are never quite accurate that convey the idea that the dead are confined to a definite place, like a being who is living in a physical body. What is experienced both after death and in initiation is that one is emerging from the body and one's whole soul being is expanding. When we follow a soul who has reached the moon sphere, as we call it, the body, in quotes, denotes the expansion of the range of experience. In actual fact, the human being grows, in a spiritual sense, to gigantic dimensions. He grows out into the spheres, but the spheres of the dead are not separate from each other, as in the case of men on earth. They are spatially intermingled. A sense of separateness arises, because consciousness is separate. Beings may be completely intermingled without knowing anything of one another. The feeling of either isolation or community after death, of which I spoke during my last visit, is connected with the interrelationships of consciousness. It is not as if a dead person were on some isolated island in a spatial sense. He pervades the other being, of whose existence he is totally unaware, although they occupy the same space. Let us now consider what comes about mainly when the period of Kamaloka is over. When an individual enters upon his devaconic existence after passing through the moon sphere, Kamaloka is not yet entirely at an end. This does not preclude the fact that it is within the moon sphere that adjustments take place that are of significance, not only as Kamaloka experiences, but also for the later life of the individual when he again enters existence through birth. We can characterize it in the following way. We can characterize in the following way what is added to the Kamaloka experiences. A man may be so active in life that he brings all his talents to expression. But there are many men of whom we have to say, when we observe them with the eyes of the soul, that, according to their faculties and talents, they could have achieved in life something quite different from what they have in fact achieved. Such people have lagged behind their talents. Something else comes into consideration. There are people who nurture a great number of intentions in the course of their life. It need not be a question of talent, but of intentions connected either with trivial or important aims. How much in life merely remains at the stage of intention without being fulfilled? There are things in this category that need not be considered blameworthy. In order to show how significant such things may be, I will mention an instance already known to some friends. Goethe embarked in his Pandora upon a poetical work, and at a certain point he came to a standstill. I once explained what happened to Goethe when writing Pandora in the following way. The very greatness that had conceived the plan of the poem prevented him from completing the work. He was incapable of unfolding the power whereby the plan could have turned into reality. It was not because of shortcomings, but in a sense because of his greatness that Goethe was prevented from completing Pandora. This is the case with some of his other works, too. He left them unfinished. The fragment of Pandora shows that Goethe made such considerable artistic demands upon himself that his powers, even in respect of the outer form of the poem, were simply not able to carry out the entire mighty plan with the same ease as in the fragment with which he was successful. This is obviously an example of an unfulfilled intention. Therefore, on the one hand, a man may lag behind his talents, owing to laziness or to defects in character or intellect. But the other possibility is that he may not be able to carry out his intentions in small or important matters. Now, there is something great in a poet who does not complete a work such as Pandora, but every imperfection in man is inscribed by him into the Akasha Chronicle in the moon sphere. And thus an abundance of shortcomings and imperfections come before the eye of the seer in the realm between earth and moon. Human imperfections, be they noble or no, are faithfully recorded there. Instances can be found in which, through physical health, through a bodily constitution providing a good foundation for intellectual gifts, a man would have been capable of achieving certain things, but failed to do so. What he could have become but had not become when he passed through the gate of death, this is inscribed in the Akasha Chronicle. Do not imagine that the end of Pandora is in some way inscribed in the moon sphere. What is inscribed has to do with Goethe's astral body, namely, that he had conceived a great, far-reaching plan and only fulfilled a part of it. All such things, including trivial matters, are inscribed between the spheres of earth and moon. A person who forms a resolution, but has not carried it out before his death, inscribes the fact of non-fulfillment in this sphere. A fairly accurate characterization can be given of what is disclosed to the eye of seership in this realm. The promise that has not been kept, for example, is not inscribed until later, actually not until the Mercury sphere is reached. An unfulfilled resolution, however, is inscribed in the moon sphere. Anything that affects not only ourselves, but also others, is not immediately inscribed in the moon sphere, but only later. Anything that affects us as individuals, that keeps us behind our proper stage of evolution, and thus denotes imperfection in our personal development, is inscribed in the moon sphere. It is important to realize that our imperfections, especially those that need not have been inevitable, are inscribed in the moon sphere. It should not be thought that, in all circumstances, such an inscription is a dreadful thing. In a certain sense, it can be of the greatest value and significance. We will speak in a moment of the meaning and purpose of these inscriptions in the Akasha Chronicle. First, it must be emphasized that as the person expands into other spheres, all his imperfections are there, inscribed. He expands from the moon sphere into the Mercury sphere. I'm speaking entirely from the aspect of occultism, not from that of ordinary astronomy. Something is inscribed by him in all the spheres. In the Mercury sphere, the Venus sphere, the Sun sphere, the Mars sphere, the Jupiter sphere, the Saturn sphere, and even beyond. Most inscriptions, however, are made within the Sun sphere, for as we heard in the last lecture, outside the Sun sphere a man mainly has to adjust matters that are not just left to his own individual discretion. Thus, after having cast away more or less completely what still draws him to the earth, man journeys through the planetary spheres and even beyond them. The contact thus established with the corresponding forces provides what he needs in his evolution between death and a new birth. When I spoke in the last lecture of man coming into contact with the higher hierarchies and receiving the gifts they bestow, that was the same as saying that his being expands into the cosmos. When the expansion has been completed, he contracts again until he has become minute enough to unite as a spirit seed with what comes from the parents. This is indeed a wonderful mystery. When a human being passes through the gate of death, he himself becomes an ever-expanding sphere. His potentialities of soul and spirit expand. He becomes a gigantic being and then again contracts. What we have within us has in fact contracted from the planetary universe. Quite literally, we bear within us what we have lived through in a planetary world. When I was here last, I said certain things about the passage through the Mercury sphere, the Venus sphere, and the Sun sphere. Today, I wish to speak about certain aspects of the passage through the Mars sphere. When a man passes from the Sun sphere into the Mars sphere, the conditions of existence into which he enters are quite different in our present age from what they were a comparatively short time ago. To the eyes of the seer, it is quite evident that there was good reason for the statements, originating from the clairvoyance once possessed by humanity, about the several bodies composing the planetary system. It was entirely in keeping with the facts that Mars was considered to be the member of our planetary system connected with all warlike, aggressive elements in the evolution of humanity. The fantastic theories advanced by physical astronomy today about a possible form of life on Mars are without foundation. The nature of the beings who may be called Mars men, if we wish to use such an expression, is altogether different from that of the men on Earth, and no comparison is possible. Until the 17th century, the character of the Mars beings had invariably been one of warlike aggressiveness. Belligerency, if one may use this word, was an inherent quality of the Mars, quote-unquote, culture. The basis of it was formed by the rivalries and clashes between souls perpetually battling with each other. as an individual was passing through the Mars sphere between death and rebirth, he came into contact with these forces of aggression, and they made their way into his soul. If, when he was born again, his innate tendencies made him specially able to develop and give expression to these forces, it was to be attributed to his passage through the Mars sphere. This subject is full of complications. On the earth we live among the beings of the three kingdoms of nature and among men. By various means we come into contact with the souls who, in their life after death, still retain some connection with the earth. But we also encounter beings who are utterly foreign to the earth. The more an initiate is able to widen his vision, the more souls are found who are strangers on the earth, and the more it is realized that wanderers are passing through the earth sphere. They are beings who are not connected with earthly life in the normal way. This is no different for us as men of earth than it is for the moon dwellers, through whose sphere of life we also pass between death and a new birth. When we are passing through the Mars sphere, for example, we are ghosts, specters for the Mars dwellers. We pass through their sphere as strangers, as alien beings. But the Mars beings, too, at a certain stage of their existence, are condemned to pass through our Earth sphere. And one who possesses certain initiate faculties encounters them when conditions are favorable. Beings of our planetary system are continually streaming past each other. While we are living on Earth, often imagining that we are surrounded only by the beings of the different kingdoms of nature, there are itinerants from all the other planets in our environment. During a certain period between death and a new birth, we too are itinerants among the other planetary, quote-unquote, men, if one might speak in this way. We have to develop in our lives on Earth the essentials of our particular mission in the present epoch of cosmic existence. Our other beings are allotted to the other planetary worlds, and between death and rebirth we must contact these worlds too. Therefore, when reference is made to one region or another of life in Devakan, it is actually the case, although it is not expressly stated, that the happenings are taking place in some sphere of our planetary system. This should be borne in mind. Thus, at a certain time in life, between death and a new birth, we pass through the Mars sphere. Just as the process of the Earth evolution is a process of descent until the time of the mystery of Golgotha, and of ascent from then onward, so also do the other planets undergo an evolution in their own way. From the year 33 AD, the date is approximately correct, the Earth entered upon an ascending process of evolution. That year was the pivotal point in the Earth's evolution. On Mars, the pivotal point was at the beginning of the 16th century. Until then, the evolution of conditions on Mars had been a process of descent, and from that time onward a process of ascent has occurred, because an event of the greatest significance for that planet then took place. In connection with Earth evolution, we know of the remarkable personage Gautama Buddha. He was a bodhisattva until, in the 29th year of his life, he rose to the rank of Buddhahood, and was then destined never to be incarnated again in a physical body on Earth. From other lectures you will have heard, however, that later on the Buddha still worked into the Earth sphere from the spiritual world. Let me read that again. From other lectures you will have heard, however, that later on the Buddha still worked into the Earth sphere from the spiritual world. He sent his forces into the astral body of the Jesus child of the Gospel of St. Luke. But in another way, too, he influenced earthly life without incarnating into a physical body. In the 7th and 8th centuries there was a mystery school in the southeast of Europe for those who, at that time, were endowed with some degree of seership. The teachers in that school were not only individualities of physical incarnation, but there were also those who work from spiritual heights only as far as the etheric body. It is possible for more highly developed men to receive instruction from individualities who no longer or never descend into a physical body. The Buddha himself was a teacher in the mystery school. Among his pupils at that time was the personality who was born later on in his next incarnation as Francis of Assisi. Many of the qualities so impressively displayed in that later life are to be traced to the fact that Francis of Assisi had been a pupil of the Buddha. Here we see how the Buddha continued to work from spiritual heights into the earth sphere after the mystery of Golgotha, and how he was connected with the life of man between birth and death. Then, in the 17th century, the Buddha withdrew from earthly existence and accomplished for Mars a deed that, although not of the magnitude of the mystery of Golgotha, nevertheless resembled it and corresponded on Mars to the mystery of Golgotha on Earth. At the beginning of the 17th century, the Buddha became the Redeemer, the Savior of Mars. He was the individuality whose mission it was to inculcate peace and harmony into the aggressive nature of Mars. Since then, the Buddha impulse is to be found on Mars, as the Christ impulse is to be found on the earth since the mystery of Golgotha. The destiny of the Buddha on Mars was not death as in the mystery of Golgotha, yet in a certain respect it too was a kind of crucifixion, inasmuch as this wonderful individuality, who in keeping with his life on earth radiated universal peace and love, was transferred into the midst of what was completely alien to him, into the aggressive, warlike element on Mars. It was Buddha's mission to exercise a pacifying influence on Mars. For the gaze of seership, there is something tremendously impressive in the picture of two collateral events. The Buddha had risen to the highest point attainable in his earthly existence, to the rank of Buddhahood, and had lived on earth as the Buddha for 50 years. Then, in his 80th year, on October 13th, 483 B.C., on a glorious moonlit night, he breathed out his being into the silvery radiance glimmering over the earth. This event, which even outwardly seems to be a manifestation of the breath of peace emanating from the Buddha, bears witness to the fact that he had attained the zenith of development within his earthly existence. It is deeply impressive to contemplate his wonderful happening in connection with that moment at the beginning of the 17th century, when, with all his abounding powers of peace and love, the Buddha went to Mars in order that those powers might stream from him into the aggressiveness prevailing there to gradually inaugurate the process of Mars's ascending evolution. When the soul passed through the Mars sphere in times before the Buddha mystery, it was endowed primarily with forces of aggressiveness. Since the Buddha mystery, a soul undergoes essentially different experiences if it is fitted by nature to gain something from the Mars forces. To avoid any misunderstanding, it must be emphasized that as little as the whole earth today is already Christianized, as little has Mars become entirely a planet of peace. That process will still take a long time, so that if a soul has any aptitude for receiving elements of aggressiveness, there is still ample opportunity for it. Nevertheless, we must not lose sight, spiritually, of the event of which we have spoken. The more deeply the earth enters into a phase of materialism, the less will anyone who really understands the evolutionary process admit that it would be natural for a man in his life between birth and death to follow Buddha in the way that men followed him in pre-Christian times. The development of natures, such as that of Francis of Assisi, will gradually become less and less possible on earth, less and less suitable for external civilization. Nevertheless, between death and rebirth, the soul is able to pass through this experience. Grotesque as it may seem, yet it corresponds to the facts. For a certain period between death and a new birth, during the passage through the Mars sphere, every human soul has the opportunity of being a Franciscan or a Buddhist and of receiving all the forces that can flow from feeling and experience of this kind. The passage through the Mars sphere can therefore be of great importance for the human soul. Man, however, inscribes his perfections and imperfections into whatever sphere he enters according to their affinity with the characteristic qualities of that sphere. Between death and rebirth, our perfections and imperfections are faithfully recorded in the Akasha Chronicle. Certain attributes are inscribed in the Moon sphere, others in the Venus sphere, others in the Mars sphere, others in the Mercury sphere, others in the Jupiter sphere, and so on. When we are returning to an incarnation in a physical body, and our being is slowly contracting, we encounter everything that was inscribed on the outward journey. In this way, our karma is prepared. On the path of return, we can inscribe into our own being the record of an imperfection we ourselves first inscribed into the Akasha Chronicle. Then we arrive on the earth. Because there is within us everything we inscribed into our being on the return journey, and we are obliged to inscribe a great deal, even if not everything, because of this our karma unfolds. Up above, however, everything still remains inscribed. Now these inscriptions work together in a remarkable way. They are engraved into the spheres, into the moon sphere, Venus sphere, and so on. These spheres are involved in certain movements, so that the following may happen. Let us say that a man has inscribed one of his imperfections into the moon sphere. While passing through the Mars sphere, he has inscribed there a quality of his character through the fact that he acquired in that sphere a certain element of aggressiveness that was not previously in him. Now in the return journey he passes through the Mars sphere again and comes back to the earth. He lives on the earth and has received into his karma what he has inscribed in the Mars sphere, but at the same time it stands recorded above him. Up there is Mars in a certain relationship to the moon. Parenthesis, the outer planets indicate the relative positions of the spheres. Parenthesis. Because Mars stands in a certain relationship to the moon, the inscription of the aggressive element and the man's imperfections are, as it were, in the same constellation. The consequence is that when the one planet stands behind the other, they work in conjunction. This is the time when the individual in question will tackle his imperfection with the aggressive quality acquired from Mars. So the position of the planets really does indicate what the man himself has first inscribed into these spheres. When in astrology we ascertain the positions of the planets, and also their relative positions to those of the fixed stars, this gives some indication of what we ourselves have inscribed. The outer planets are in this case a less important factor. What actually has an effect upon us is what we ourselves have inscribed in the several spheres. Here is the real reason why the planetary constellations have an effect upon man's nature. It is because he actually passes through the several planetary spheres. When the moon stands in a certain relationship to Mars and to some fixed star, this constellation works as a whole. That is to say, the Mars quality, moon and fixed star, work in conjunction upon the man and bring about what this combined influence is able to achieve. So it is really the moral inheritance deposited by us between death and rebirth that appears again in a new life as a stellar constellation in our karma. That is the deeper basis of the connection between the stellar constellation and man's karma. Thus, if we study the life of a man between death and a new birth, we perceive how significantly he is connected with the whole cosmos. An element of necessity enters into a man's connection with the realms lying beyond the sun sphere. Let us consider the Saturn sphere in particular. If during his present earth life a man has made efforts to master the concepts of spiritual science, the passage through the Saturn sphere is of special significance for his next life. It is in this sphere that the conditions are created that enable him to transmute the forces acquired through the knowledge of spiritual science or anthroposophy into forces that elaborate his bodily constitution in such a way that in his coming life he has a natural inclination toward the spiritual. A human being may grow up today and be educated as a materialist, Protestant, or Catholic. Spiritual science approaches him. He is receptive to it and does not reject it. He inwardly accepts it. He now passes through the gate of death. He enters the Saturn sphere. In passing through it, he absorbs the forces that make him in his next life a spiritual man, who shows even as a child an inclination to the spiritual. It is the function of every sphere through which we pass between death and rebirth to transform what our souls have assimilated during an incarnation into forces that can then become bodily forces and endow us with certain faculties. Yesterday I could only go as far as is possible in a public lecture when I said that the true Christian impulses were already in Raphael when he was born. This must not be taken to imply that Raphael brought with him some definite Christian concepts or ideas. I have said impulses, not concepts. What has been taken into the conceptual life in one incarnation is united with the human being in quite a different form. It appears as impulses or forces. The power that enabled Raphael to create those delicate, wonderful figures of Christianity in his paintings came from his earlier incarnations. We are justified in speaking of him as a, quote, born Christian, unquote. Most of you know that Raphael had been incarnated previously as John the Baptist, and it was then that the impulses that appeared in the Raphael existence as inborn Christian impulses had penetrated into his soul. It must always be emphasized that conjectures and comparisons may lead far off the mark when speaking about successive incarnations. To the eyes of seership, they present themselves in such a way that in most cases one would not take one life to be the cause of the next, in order that something assimilated in the life of the soul in one incarnation may be able to unfold forces in the next incarnation. That work upon the bodily foundation of talents, we must pass through the period from death to rebirth. On earth and with terrestrial forces, it is impossible to transform what our souls have experienced in earthly life into forces capable of working upon the bodily constitution itself. Man in his totality is not an earth being, and his physical form would have a grotesque appearance according to modern ideas if only those forces present in the earth sphere could be applied to his bodily development. When an individual comes into existence through birth, he must bear within him the forces of the cosmos, and these forces must continue to work within him if he is to assume human form. Forces that build up and give shape to such forms cannot be found within the earth sphere. This must be borne in mind. Thus, in what he is, man bears the image of the cosmos in himself, not merely that of the earth. It is a sin against the true nature of man to trace his source and origin to earthly forces, and to study only what can be observed externally in the kingdoms of the earth through natural science. Nor should we ignore the fact that everything a man receives from the earth is dominated by what he brings with him from those super-earthly spheres through which he passes between death and rebirth. Within these several spheres, he becomes a servant of one or the other of the higher hierarchies. What is inscribed in the Akasha Chronicle between the earth and the moon is of special importance, because it is there that, among other things, all imperfections are recorded. It should be realized that the inscribing of these imperfections is governed by the view that every record there is of significance for the individual's own evolution, either furthering or hindering his progress. Because it is there inscribed in the Akasha Chronicle between earth and moon, it also becomes significant for the evolution of the earth as a whole. The imperfections of really great men are also recorded in that sphere. One example of tremendous interest for clairvoyant observation is Leonardo da Vinci. He is a spirit of greatness and universality equaled by few others on earth. But compared with what he intended, his actual achievements in the external world in many respects remain incomplete. As a matter of fact, no man of similar eminence left as much uncompleted as Leonardo da Vinci. The consequence of this was that a colossal amount was inscribed by him in the moon sphere, so much indeed that one is often bound to exclaim, quote, "How could all that is inscribed there possibly have reached perfection on the earth?" Unquote. At this point, I want to tell you something that seemed to me quite significant when I was studying Leonardo da Vinci. I was to give a lecture about him in Berlin, and a particular observation made in connection with him seemed to be extremely important. It fills one with sadness today to see on the wall of the Church of Santa Maria della Grazia in Milan the rapidly disappearing colors that now convey no more than a faint shadow of what the picture once was. If we remember that Leonardo took 16 years to paint this picture, and think of how he painted it, we gain a definite impression. It is known that he would often go away for a long time. Then he would return to the picture, sit in front of it for many hours, make a few strokes with the brush, and go off again. It is also known that many times he felt unable to express what he wished in the painting and suffered terrible fits of depression on this account. Now it happened that a new prior was appointed to the monastery at a time when Leonardo had already been working at the picture for many years. This prior was a pedantic and strict disciplinarian with little understanding of art. He asked impatiently why the painter could not finish the picture, reproached him for it, and also complained to Duke Ludovico. The Duke repeated the complaint to Leonardo, and he answered, quote, "I do not know whether I shall ever be able to complete this picture. I have prototypes in life for all the figures, except those of Judas and Christ. For them I have no models, although in the case of Judas, if no model turns up, I can always take the prior. But for the Christ I have no prototype." Unquote. That, however, is digressing. What I want to say is that when one looks today at the figure of Judas in the picture that has almost completely faded, a shadow is to be seen on this figure, a shadow that cannot be explained in any way, either by the in-streaming light or by anything else. Occult investigation finds that the painting was never as Leonardo da Vinci really wanted it to be. with the exception of the figures of Judas and Christ and the Christ. He wanted to portray everything through light and shadow, but Judas was to be portrayed in such a way as to give the impression that darkness dominated the countenance from within. This was not intended to be conveyed by external contrasts of light and shadows. In the figure of Christ, the impression was to be that the light on his countenance was shining from within, radiating outward from within. But at this point, disharmony beset Leonardo's inner life, and the effect he desired was never produced. This affords a clue when one is observing the many remaining inscriptions made by Leonardo in the moon sphere. It is an example of something that could not be brought to fulfillment in the earth sphere. When the period following that of Leonardo da Vinci is investigated, it is found that Leonardo continued to work through a number of those who lived after him. Even externally, there can be found in Leonardo's writings things that later on were demonstrated by scientists and also by artists. In fact, the whole subsequent period was under his influence. It was then discovered that the inscribed imperfections worked as inspirations into the souls of Leonardo's successors, into the souls of men who lived after him. The imperfections of an earlier epoch are still more important for the following epoch than its perfections. The perfections are there to be studied, but what has been elaborated to a certain degree of perfection on the earth has, as it were, reached an end, has come to a conclusion in evolution. What has not been perfected is the seed of the following divine evolutionary process. Here we come to a remarkable, magnificent paradox. The greatest blessing for a subsequent period is the fruitful imperfection, the fruitful, justifiable imperfection of an earlier period. What has been perfected in an earlier epoch is there to be enjoyed. Imperfection, however, imperfection originating in great men whose influences have remained for posterity, helps to promote creative activity in the following period. Hence there is obviously tremendous wisdom in the fact that imperfections remain in the neighborhood of the earth, inscribed in the records of the Akasha Chronicle between earth and moon. This brings us to the point where we can begin to understand the principle that perfection signifies for the different epochs the end of a stream of evolution, and imperfection the beginning of an evolutionary stream. For imperfection in this sense, men should actually be thankful to the gods. What is the purpose of studies such as are contained in this lecture? The purpose is to make man's connection with the macrocosm more and more comprehensible, to show how men bear the macrocosm compressed within them, and also how they can be related to their spiritual environment. Realization of what these things mean can then be transformed into a feeling that pervades a man in such a way that he combines with this knowledge a concept of his dignity that does not make him arrogant, but fills him with a sense of responsibility, prompts him to believe not that he may squander his powers, but he must use them. It must, of course, be emphasized that it would be futile to say, I had better leave imperfect such faculties as I possess. Nothing whatever could be gained by such an attitude. If a man were deliberately to ignore his imperfections, he would, it is true, inscribe them as described, but they would have no light, nor would they be capable of having any effect. Only those imperfections that are inscribed because they were due to necessity and not the result of laziness can work in the way that has been described. The end of Lecture 13.